Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Killer Psyche ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
A listener note, this episode contains adult content and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised. On the Sunday before Kathleen Grundy was found dead on June 24, 1998, a neighbor recalled seeing her outside her tidy brick row house, trimming bushes in her garden. Not only was she well known to many residents of Hyde, located on the outskirts of Manchester, England, she was once mayor of the struggling mill town. She lived alone, and in the days leading up to her death, she never once mentioned feeling ill to her daughter, Angela Woodruff. The two spoke on the phone regularly, and Angela often joked that her mother was the most fit member of the family, even at 81. So when her mother's physician, Dr. Harold Shipman, called to tell her the sad news, Angela was shocked. When she asked the doctor for more information, he was vague. He claimed on the day before she died, he saw Kathleen Grundy for a routine matter and she complained about not feeling well. So they decided he would make a house call the next morning to take a blood sample for what he claimed was a study he was doing. He arrived at her home at around 8 a.m., because he said the sample needed to be obtained first thing in the morning. Since he was her trusted doctor for years, she saw no reason to question him. But in the immediate aftermath of her mother's surprising death, Angela Woodruff became very suspicious and began her own investigation. And upon realizing that her mother bequeathed her entire estate to Dr. Shipman, Angela's fears were confirmed. But that turned out to be just the beginning. And Angela's push for answers helped capture the most prolific serial killer in the history of the United Kingdom. As a Killer Psyche listener, you'll love Audible's new pulse-pounding collection of exclusive thrillers that are guaranteed to keep you on the edge of your seat. With captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances, their titles are brought to life. I recommend The Killer Across the Table by John Douglas, my mentor at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, and his co-author, Mark Olshacker. It is great. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. That's audible.com/psyche or text psyche to 500-500. Killer Psyche is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Wondery and Treefort, I'm Candace DeLong, and this is the second season of Killer Psyche. I've spent 5 decades studying people's minds through my work as an FBI profiler and psychiatric nurse. I've interviewed dozens of murderers, including serial killers. And the question of why they did it is what I get asked time and time again. I want to give you a satisfying answer, so I'm diving deep into the mindsets of these criminals to give you my best analysis of what made them do what they did. This episode is part one of the original Dr. Death, Harold Frederick Shipman. In the 3 decades that Fred Shipman practiced medicine, between 1970 and 1998, he likely killed more than 250 people. The majority of his victims were elderly, and all of them were his patients. He convinced families and loved ones that these deaths were natural, and he often reinforced his conclusions by forging medical records. The doctor would probably have continued killing if not for Angela Woodruff, the grieving daughter investigating her mother's suspicious will, and a taxi driver who shared many of the same elderly clients with Shipman. Kathleen Grundy was energetic and very social. She still worked 2 days a week at the Village Thrift Shop in Hyde and volunteered part-time for various charities. She loved to travel and had just returned home from a trip to Derbyshire, where everyone there said she was the life of the party. Dr. Shipman, too, was popular in Hyde, seemingly available to his patients at all hours of the day and night. He was a caring, trustworthy, solo practitioner with a very large number of elderly female patients. The first indication that something was wrong with Kathleen was late Wednesday morning, June 24th, when she did not show up for the Pensioners Luncheon Club. She was the main organizer of the thrice-weekly gathering, so it was unusual that she was not there to prep, serve, and clean up after the meals. At 11:20, the manager phoned her home. There was no answer. Fearing something was wrong, the manager and a luncheon attendee went to Kathleen's house. They found the front door unlocked, which was not unusual for her. Inside, they discovered Kathleen, fully dressed, curled up, and motionless on her living room sofa, as if asleep. Her skin, however, was gray and her lips were blue. She was cold to their touch. Instead of calling emergency services, her friends called her physician, Dr. Harold Shipman, who appeared minutes later and, without even checking her pulse, declared Kathleen Grundy dead, most probably of coronary thrombosis, given that she had a history of cardiac problems. Her friends were stunned. To them, she was the picture of health. In fact, just recently, one of her friends saw her gracefully leap off the last step of the city bus as it was still moving. Her friends were not the only ones baffled by Kathleen's sudden death. Her only daughter, Angela Woodruff, a successful solicitor living about 100 miles from Hyde, was too. After the police informed Woodruff that Dr. Shipman had been to the home and certified her mother's death, she called and questioned him about his visit earlier that morning. Brusque and evasive, he said Kathleen visited his office the day before her death and complained of indigestion. He thought those symptoms were, maybe, indicative of more serious developments. He also said she suffered from a blockage impeding the flow of blood to her heart, or coronary thrombosis. This made no sense to Woodruff. She was close to her mother, and this was never mentioned by her. On Kathleen Grundy's death certificate, Shipman recorded, quote, old age as her cause of death. That itself was not so unusual. Old age was often listed as the cause of death when an older person had a long period of declining health or organ failure of any kind. But this was not Kathleen Grundy. 3 weeks after her mother's death, Angela Woodruff received another shock. She learned her mother had typed up a new will and sent it to an unknown solicitor in Hyde. The solicitor got it in the mail along with a letter requesting he log it for her. This was the first contact Kathleen Grundy had with that solicitor's office, but 4 days after her death, another letter arrived. This one from a J. Smith, informing the solicitor of Kathleen's death. The solicitor, thank goodness, was not willing to start distributing Kathleen's estate without further information. So the office tracked down her daughter, Angela. The new will was dated June 9, 1998, just 15 days before her death, accompanied by a letter which said, quote, "Dear Sir, I enclose a copy of my will. I think it is clear in intent. I wish Dr. Shipman to benefit by having my estate. I would like you to be the executor of the will. I intend to make an appointment to discuss this and my will in the near future." Both the will and the letter were typed on the same faulty typewriter and signed by Kathleen Grundy. Under the will, Dr. Harold Shipman was designated as the sole beneficiary of Grundy's £400,000 estate. The will further stated, quote, "I give all my estate, money, and home to my doctor. My family is not in need, and I want to reward him for all the care he has given to me and the people of Hyde. He is sensible enough to handle any problems this may give him." The will also indicated that Kathleen wished to be cremated. Angela could not believe her mother wrote up a new will and did not tell her. As a solicitor, she always did any necessary legal work on her mother's behalf. In fact, she was very experienced in probate law and prepared a version of her mother's will in 1986, which stated Angela and her two sons were to inherit Kathleen's entire estate. The family had not fallen out. Her mother had no signs of dementia and no recent change in her personality. Furthermore, her mother had always said she wanted a full burial, not to be cremated. Every detail was out of character for her meticulous mother. When Angela Woodruff received photocopies of the will and letter, she immediately saw how sloppy and amateurish they were. The phraseology was not her mother's. There were typos. The formatting was incorrect. And some of the typewriter keys did not evenly strike the ribbon, making certain letters appear faint and difficult to read. The presentation would have embarrassed the fastidious Kathleen, who once worked as a secretary and later a teacher. The biggest red flag? Her signature was off. It was too large and looked as if it were traced. The solicitor urged Angela to go to the police. But first, Angela investigated the two witnesses whose signatures were on the document. One witness acknowledged signing a document in Dr. Shipman's office, but said it was folded over so that only the line for his signature was visible. That man was shocked to learn he had served as witness for a will. The other witness flatly denied it was her signature. On July 24, 1998, Angela took the forged will to the local police in Warwickshire, who passed it along to the Greater Manchester Police. The document set off alarm bells because just 4 months earlier, Dr. Shipman was the subject of an investigation, focusing on the high number of patients who died under his care. These earlier suspicions about Dr. Shipman were raised by Dr. Linda Reynolds, a partner with the Brook Surgery Practice in Hyde. The surgery practice was directly across the street from Dr. Shipman's, and the physicians there often countersigned required medical documents for Shipman, including death certificates. In March of 1998, Dr. Reynolds became concerned about how many of Shipman's elderly patients were dying in curiously similar circumstances. Dr. Reynolds alerted the coroner for the Greater Manchester South District, John Pollard, who initiated a limited police investigation based on Dr. Reynolds' concerns. The Manchester detective assigned to the case concluded nothing criminal occurred and closed the inquiry. Apparently, he was wrong. Now, just 4 months later, the Manchester inspector heading this forgery investigation had Kathleen Grundy's will processed for fingerprints. Only Dr. Shipman's prints were found. The inspector then knew he had to exhume Kathleen's body and conduct a post-mortem. Manchester police had never exhumed a body before, so this was an extremely disruptive and sensitive event for everyone involved. With Angela's permission, the police set up tarps to block prying eyes and remove Kathleen Grundy's body from its casket. They took soil samples from the four sides of the grave to ensure nothing had leaked into the casket. On the same day, concerned that Shipman would hear of the exhumation and destroy evidence, Manchester police executed a search warrant for his office. The doctor was arrogant and dismissive of the investigators who questioned him, but he did admit to owning the aging typewriter used to create the will and letter. And he showed it to the police. Shipman claimed that Kathleen Grundy routinely borrowed it. However, when the fingerprint expert examined the typewriter, only Shipman's and his wife's prints were found on it. At the same time, police also executed a search warrant at Shipman's home. The condition of the home was shocking. Every room had piles of clothes, clutter, and dirty dishes. They were accustomed to entering neglected homes, but never expected to see conditions like this in a doctor's home. It was so filthy, one policeman said it was the type of place, quote, you wiped your shoes on the way out. The police found boxes of patient records in random rooms, along with some files in plastic grocery store bags. They seized a hoard of rings, necklaces, bracelets, and earrings, some with little value and many decades out of fashion. Many of the rings were obviously too small for his wife's fingers, and the police believed they may have come from his deceased patients. During the postmortem on Kathleen, the pathologist found that she had healthy organs and no other signs of disease. The only thing remarkable about her physical condition, she was in extraordinarily good shape for an 81-year-old woman. The pathologist took tissue samples and sent them off to a specialized lab. By August 20th, roughly 8 weeks since Kathleen's death, the press was aware of the Shipman investigation. Newspaper headlines told how Manchester police had exhumed the body of a Hyde widow after her daughter objected to the mother's will and raised suspicions about the manner of her death. While many in Hyde rushed to Dr. Shipman's defense, others started coming to the police with suspicious stories of their loved ones' passings. A forensic document examiner confirmed soon after the public became aware of the case that the signatures on Kathleen Grundy's new will were forgeries, and the will itself had probably been done on the typewriter seized from Shipman's office. And then, on August 28th, police finally received results from the tissue samples. They confirmed that she had lethal levels of diamorphine, otherwise known as medical-grade heroin. Harold Shipman was arrested and charged with forgery, attempting to obtain property by deception, and the murder of Kathleen Grundy. In the meantime, police started examining other recent deaths of Shipman's patients. And as the number of his victims grew, the scope of his crimes would shock the entire world. Killer Psyche is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up for spring, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Whether you thrive around people or you prefer some more alone time, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that does not drain your battery. Your therapist can help you identify triggers and appropriate coping mechanisms so you can continue to build helpful habits. Plus, therapy can be beneficial for everyone, not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/psyche today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/psyche. Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe as ex-homicide detective Roy Freeman. Freeman is forced to piece together the brutal evidence from a decade-old murder investigation. With only instincts to trust, he faces a chilling truth. Sometimes it's best to let sleeping dogs lie. I'm really looking forward to this movie. I have interviewed some people that had a fractured mind regarding traumatic events. This is going to be good. Watch Sleeping Dogs now on digital. On sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery. Harold Frederick Shipman was born on January 14, 1946, in Nottingham, England. He was the second of three children. His sister Polly was 7 years older and his brother Clive about 4 years younger. His father, Harold Sr., was a long-distance lorry driver, and in order to avoid confusion, the family often called Harold Jr. Freddie or Fred. Harold Sr., his wife Vera, and the children lived in Bestwood Council Estates, which might be considered government-subsidized housing today, but then were occupied by low-income families. Both of Fred's parents were from working-class backgrounds, but his mother had middle-class aspirations for her children because she was denied those opportunities in her own upbringing. The Shipmans were observant Methodists, and Vera worked particularly hard to keep undesirable influences from reaching her children. For example, she did not allow them to play with other kids in the neighborhood. She also repeatedly told them that they were better than the other children. They reciprocated by trying not to ever disappoint her. The Shipman children were very well behaved. Their mother never had to raise her voice. A look from her sufficed. This is a trait that Fred also possessed. In later years, some would comment that while he was arrogant, he never raised his voice. Unlike his siblings, Fred did well in school, eventually gaining acceptance into a grammar school for children who had demonstrated academic achievement. Because of this, Vera pinned all of her hopes on him. His schoolwork became the focus of the entire family. They all made sacrifices to ensure he had all the extras he needed to attend his new school. Though there are certainly advantages to being the favorite child, it is not always the best for development of self. In an article in Psychology Today, psychologist Dr. Ellen Libby writes that favorite children will often grow up believing that they will get what they want, when they want it, and are not held accountable for their bad acts, like their siblings are. As a result, they grow up, quote, less prepared to function effectively in the world. These children often grow up sheltered from reality, and their sense of entitlement and disregard for boundaries will harm their development in the long run. While Fred might have been an academic standout in his old school, he was just average at the new one. His classmates remembered him as very reserved, not necessarily an outsider, but aloof by choice. Whenever another teenage boy made a joke, for example, he did not laugh. Freddie also did not date. He attended school dances with his older sister, Polly, and classmates reported that because she was taller and older, they looked extremely awkward dancing together. Fred was, however, a very good athlete and excelled at rugby and distance running. In contrast to his reserved personality in class, he was very aggressive, competitive, and boisterous in sports. During Fred's teen years, his mother became sick with lung cancer. At the time, there were not effective treatments, and she deteriorated quickly. As her disease advanced, so did her pain. Toward the end of Vera's life, her doctor made house visits and injected her with increasing amounts of morphine to alleviate her suffering. But her hopes for Freddie never faded. Every afternoon, she sat in a chair by the front window, a cup of tea in her hands, waiting for him to come home and tell her about his day at school. Dr. Libby's article in Psychology Today also states that, quote, favorite children grow up with unrealistic expectations. They falsely believe that others will love them and admire them as much as their parents did. Often, it is not until the important parent has died that this child must confront the profoundness of a void that they cannot fill. On June 1, 1963, the family gathered by Vera's side while she took her last breath. She was only 47 years old. Fred Shipman was 17 when his mother died. Reportedly, when she passed, he left the house and ran all night in the pouring rain. The Monday after Vera's death, a classmate of Fred's asked about his weekend. Fred replied with little emotion, "My mother died." Fred had never even spoken about his mother being ill. His mother's cancer battle motivated Fred to study medicine, but he failed to get into medical school when he first applied. In 1965, on his second attempt, he was accepted to the University of Leeds Medical School. There, Fred was assigned housing in a private home that rented rooms to the university's med students. He was diligent and hardworking, but this was also his first real taste of freedom, since his mother had always kept a very close watch on him. One day, while riding the bus to the university, he exchanged glances with a 17-year-old named Primrose Oxtoby. She had a lot in common with Fred. She, too, was raised in a strict Methodist working-class home with a very ambitious mother who kept her socially isolated from other children. But that was where the similarities in their backgrounds ended. Primrose had gone on to trade school and finished an art and design course, after which she landed a job as a window dresser at a store in Leeds. The flirtatious glances between Fred and Primrose turned into chatting, then dates. Neither had ever been in a relationship before, and things moved very quickly. Within months, Primrose became pregnant. In 1966, in England, her options were to give the child up for adoption or get married. Her mother was devastated. She detested Fred Shipman. She arranged for Primrose and Fred to be married in a courthouse 20 miles from their hometown. Only their fathers were present, and there was no celebration. By this time, Primrose was 6 months pregnant, and the family did not want to call any attention to the union. On Valentine's Day, 1967, their first daughter was born. Fred was just starting his second year of medical school. Money was tight, and so he, Primrose, and the baby moved into a small studio. In 1970, Fred graduated from medical school and went on to complete 2 residencies, one in pediatrics, the other in obstetrics and gynecology. It was during the 3rd year of his OBGYN residency that Fred became addicted to a drug called pethidine, a synthetic opioid commonly used in childbirth. Pethidine's brand name is Demerol. In April 1971, a year after passing his medical boards, Primrose and Fred had their second child, a son. By 1974, Shipman took his first position as a general practitioner in a busy office. He made enemies by being confrontational and combative and seemed to relish winning arguments and proving his superior medical knowledge. He frequently called the non-medical staff stupid. However, the other physicians tolerated him because he was hardworking and a very skilled doctor. In February 1975, the Home Office Drugs Inspectorate and the local police narcotics squad noticed that Shipman was obtaining abnormally large amounts of pethidine for injection from local pharmacies. After an investigation with pharmacists, the other doctors in the practice, and Shipman himself, the drug inspectors were reassured by his solid reputation that no drug abuse was occurring. How wrong they were. The very next month, Harold Shipman killed his first official victim. 70-year-old Eva Lyons, who was suffering from terminal cancer, was paid a visit to her home by Dr. Shipman, who gave her an injection through a vein in her hand. An autopsy later confirmed that Shipman had administered an intentional overdose. Around the time of Eva Lyons' death, Shipman started experiencing blackouts. After he fell in the bath at home and hit his head, he told his colleagues he was diagnosed with epilepsy. This was unwelcome news. The physician's office made regular house calls to their patients' homes. If Shipman could not drive, he would have to quit. But Primrose stepped in and drove her husband to his appointments, saving his job. In June 1975, the Home Office Drugs Inspectorate opened a second inquiry into Shipman's excessive drug orders. The large quantities of pethidine he ordered did not match the inventory in the practice's ledger. But the practice's inadequate documentation meant drug inspectors could not prove abuse. Later that summer, a sharp-eyed receptionist from the practice was visiting the chemist where doctors frequently had patients' prescriptions filled. She saw on the open controlled drug ledger that Shipman ordered frequent and excessive amounts of pethidine in the names of several of their patients. She shared this information with the other doctors. An investigation discovered Shipman was writing prescriptions for patients who, when contacted, verified they had never taken pethidine. When confronted, Shipman surprisingly admitted that he became addicted to pethidine during medical school and asked that they simply forget about the whole matter. Well, I'll let you take a guess at whether that worked. And here's a hint. It did not. Instead, they fired him and insisted he go into rehab. Shipman was irate, but had little choice if he wanted any chance of keeping his license. He had to go. It is not uncommon for physicians and other healthcare professionals to suffer from substance abuse. An article in Mayo Clinic Proceedings, the peer-reviewed medical journal from the Mayo Clinic, says that approximately 10 to 12% of physicians will develop a substance abuse disorder in their careers. Their easy access to opioids and painkillers makes them prime candidates for addiction. Shipman spent 5 months in a private psychiatric hospital where he successfully withdrew from pethidine. An attending psychiatrist there diagnosed him with moderately severe depression. He was put on antidepressants, and his general state improved. However, the psychiatrist overseeing his care registered him as a drug user, which meant that he had to disclose this information whenever he applied for a new job. During this time at the psychiatric hospital, a police officer came and questioned him about the forged prescriptions. Shipman told the officer he had started injecting pethidine only recently because of the stress of working with the other doctors in his practice. The experienced officer, however, noticed the collapsed veins in Shipman's arms and legs and knew the doctor was lying. There was no doubt that he had been abusing drugs for several years. Meanwhile, because Fred was not earning an income, the Shipmans were forced to sell their home. Primrose and the children temporarily moved in with her parents. The new owners of the Shipmans' home told the neighbors that the house was so filthy, it required extra cleaning before they could even move in. Shipman was released from the hospital in late December 1975, and by this time, He was no longer having blackouts or seizures, an indication that drug abuse, not epilepsy, was the cause. He started driving again and soon found work as a medical officer in Durham. The position was a liaison between local physicians and authorities. In this position, he did not see patients or dispense any medications. But Fred Shipman was not satisfied. He was determined to get back to a general medicine practice.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
In the fall of 1977, he saw an ad in the British Medical Journal for a position in Hyde. During his interview, Shipman was truthful about his drug addiction with the other physicians, and they appreciated his candor. He joined their practice, inheriting a roster of some 2,000 patients from the departing doctor. By the time Shipman started working in Hyde in October 1977, he was in debt. He had been fined for the forgeries he did and was making monthly payments. He was also forced to take out a loan to buy into the practice where the physicians shared a common facility and staff and purchased all of the medical equipment and supplies as a group. Each physician had his list of patients, and while there was some shared revenue, they were essentially individual earners. The more you worked, the more you earned. Shipman worked tirelessly. He built up a huge patient load and often covered night and weekend shifts. He was also blocking off afternoons for regular home visits, something his colleagues were not in the habit of doing. Shipman made himself available to his patients 24/7. And took time with each patient and gave them his full attention. He was very popular and well-liked, except by his office staff. With them, Shipman was arrogant and rude. He did not greet the receptionist when he arrived or left. Like his mother, he never raised his voice when upset. His weapon was sarcasm. He particularly disliked the office manager because she would not fire personnel he did not like. Shipman was verbally abusive to her until his last 18 months at the practice. At that point, he refused to speak to her and made her write down everything she wanted to say to him on paper. The other doctors conceded that he was pushy and wanted his own way, but he was polite to them. The nurses reported that he was controlling and wanted to do his own injections and blood draws. One colleague said that Shipman's major failing was that he always had to prove he had superior medical knowledge and was better than the other doctors. A good deal of this behavior stems from a personality disorder that most Killer Psyche fans have heard about many times before, narcissism. In case you're not familiar with this term, narcissistic personality disorder is a mental condition in which, according to the Mayo Clinic, quote, people have an inflated sense of their own importance, a deep need for excessive attention and admiration. They have troubled relationships, and lack empathy for other people. Narcissists, grandiose narcissists in particular, can often be arrogant, patronizing, and demanding. These traits perfectly describe Dr. Harold Shipman. Grandiose narcissists are often people who have been treated as superior in their childhood. Want to know how to create a narcissist? Do what Shipman's mother did to him. His mother validated these feelings and enforced them by separating him from his peers, telling him he was better than they were, and focusing on his needs above his siblings. What his colleagues did not know, that in 1978, Shipman had murdered at least four of his patients. The youngest victim was a 73-year-old who was suffering from cancer. It is likely Shipman prescribed opioids for him. From his death, as well as the deaths of two other cancer patients, Shipman could have retained excess drugs, which investigators suspect he later used to kill an 88-year-old patient on December 20th, 1978. But Shipman was just getting started. Next week on Killer Psyche, Harold Shipman, Part 2. If you like our show, please give us a rating and review. Follow Killer Psyche on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen 1 week early and ad-free. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. By supporting them, you help us offer the show for free. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery and Treefort Media, this is Killer Psyche. I'm your host, Candace DeLong. This episode was written and produced by Lisa Ammerman and Julie Burke. Story research and additional writing by Ann Liu. Mix and sound design by Joshua Morales. Senior audio producer, Maxwell Carney. Head of audio, Tom Monahan. With assistance from Lee Albanese. Renee Levesque is our production manager. Brandon Clark, Lindsay Whistler, Colin Modell, and Jada Williams are production assistants. Oscar Guido is the producer from Treefort Media. From Amazon Music and Wondery, the producer is Stephanie Joaquin. And the co-executive producer is Julie Burke. Lastly, our executive producers are Kelly Garner and Lisa Ammerman for Treefort and Marshall Louie and Aaron O'Flaherty for Wondery. The series is produced by Wondery and Treefort Media.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.